All right, good afternoon. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. And I love listening to Carrie. I just, I got to tell you, she talks to my alcoholic heart or my alcoholic soul. And it's because she's enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous. And you don't need to be somebody, in order to talk to my alcoholic soul or my alcoholic heart, you don't need to be as well-versed as she is and have an understanding like she does. But if anybody who is making an honest desire in their sharing to tell the truth about what they believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks to me in a way that nobody else on the planet can talk to me. It does something that I crave. Before I get going on what I want to talk about, I want to talk about the Big Book as a whole. First of all, got a first edition for you. Not to give to you, but just so that in between now and tonight, you can take a look at a first edition. It's the 21st printing. Just brought it with me just because maybe there's not that many in Iceland. They're somewhat common in the U.S., and you can run across them at conventions and archives all over the place. But just thought I'd bring it so you can kind of take a look at it. Be a little bit careful and do not steal it, please. But I want to talk about every time that I've been here, whether it was before your old translation of the Big Book and your new translation of the Big Book, everybody says, and it was brought up again twice to me by people, that as I read certain things today and or Carrie was making reference to things, that you have a different, even in the new translation that was done, I believe, in 2003, that there are subtle differences. And there's a danger in that, because the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is widely believed to be a divinely inspired book. And literary and spiritual experts define a divinely inspired book as the following. It must meet these two criteria to be labeled by literary experts and spiritual experts. And I don't know what either one of those really are, but there are people that claim that. It must meet two criteria. One, did the author at that time that the book was written have the ability to write this? And the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous was written mainly by Bill and approved and edited by the first 100, and they were all under 3, maybe Bill was close to 4 years sober by the time it was finished. I don't ever say this, but my great-grandfather sponsor says he even is very hesitant about getting into a car with somebody less than 5 years sober. So we can immediately claim Bill and the first 100 did not have the ability, either as writers or having had the time to be on a spiritual journey long enough to write such a book that speaks to millions. The second requirement to be thought of as a divinely inspired piece of literature is, does it say something different to you at different times of your life? Do the same sentences take on new meaning? Do the same paragraphs, the same pages, same chapters take on completely different meanings at different times in your life? And anyone who has been here in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while knows that you can be studying the book and think you really know it, and 5 years later, you're going through the exact same couple of paragraphs, and you go, oh, I've never seen that before. Did somebody change the book? Right? How many people have had that experience? Absolutely. So, other divinely inspired books by literary experts and spiritual experts, one would be the Bible, the Torah, the Quran. They all say they meet these criteria. And over the years, there have been numerous translations, and I'll just use the Bible as an expert because I don't know about translations of the Torah and the Quran, but there have been numerous translations through the years of the Bible. And no matter if you are going to be translating something, a divinely inspired book, it means we are reading what the person at that time in their life, and even if they are a sober alcoholic, reading what they were perceiving at that time. not the exact, and little words like and or just they decided that this word means this to them, can completely change the meaning for you. All I'm encouraging you to do, because you, as Icelanders, and you guys, what is it? If you have a high school diploma, you know three languages minimum. If you get a college degree, you might know seven or nine, for God's sake. But all of you know English very, very well. And I would strongly encourage you to be cross-referencing to the English Big Book on a regular basis, and maybe even make that your primary source of information of Alcoholics Anonymous, and your Icelandic version your secondary source. Just an encouragement. It's not saying you have to. Just an encouragement that you really read what was originally written by somebody who couldn't have written it. Right? So, I'm going to try to scoot through and touch on a bunch of different stuff, and I'm not even sure how far I'm going to get or where I'm going to go, but we're just going to have fun. I'm going to talk a little bit about the spiritual malady. I described to you last night allergy to the body, obsession of mind. I cannot drink successfully. I cannot on my own not drink successfully. And that is my mental and physical relationship to alcohol. I also have a spiritual connection to alcohol, a deep and profound spiritual connection to alcohol. And I could not have described that to you until the year 2000, and that meant I was already 13 years sober. I would have tried to, but I couldn't. And I had one of these experiences that just sort of like blew me away. And it happened actually on the second leg of the trip when I first came to Iceland and met you people, and that was a profound experience in my life in 2000 when I first came and accidentally stumbled into the Yellow House, and you guys all thought I was new, some Icelandic guy that was new and, you know, did what you do and tried to 12-step me. Literally, that's the way you initially treated me, and it was wonderful, wonderful. But after that 8 days, when I came with my mother, we went down to the south of France to meet my brother and his wife and his kids. Right? They were staying in a villa in the south of France for the summer. Remember, some of the first 200 employees of Microsoft, that explains that kind of living, right? And they had nannies and stuff for the summer. And one of the nights that we were there, my brother said, "Mom, let's all four of us, meaning his wife and him and me, my mother, we'll have the nannies watch the kids, and we will go out for a 13-course French meal." It's like, absolutely. And Carl, they serve wine, so you're driving, right? So, because I'm going to be the sober one, I'm going to drive. So we drive, and we go to this at least 1,000-year-old French chateau in the countryside. And we're out in this courtyard, and they start serving each course of this 13-course meal. And if you've ever had one of these, with each course, they bring a small little glass of wine. And the maitre d' or the waiter will give you a description of the vineyard that this wine came from, the family behind the vineyard, and the history of the family. All very interesting. And they bring it with each little glass of wine that's supposed to match. Apparently, you're supposed to match food with wine. I'm not aware of this, really. But, right, there's a certain kind of wine you're supposed to have with each certain kind of food. I was learning this, right? But they're very little glasses. I mean, just little. And my brother and his wife were indeed, if there's ever an appropriate place to drink a little extra, alcoholic or not alcoholic, this is the place, right? I mean, a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and indeed, my brother and his wife were having a good time and trying these, and if they liked one of them, they would tell the waiter, "Oh, we'd like to try another one of those, and tell us that story again." Right? They're having a little extra, right? Me, I'm 13 years sober at the time, so I'm trying all the Diet Cokes of the region. And I was asking the waiter, "Got a story about this at all?" And no story. But my mother, if there's ever a non-addictive personality on the planet, it's her. None. I mean, it's just really bizarre. Never. None of any type. After about two, she had been served her third very small glass of wine. She tells the waiter, "No more for me." And I was like, "Mom, come on, I'm driving. Look at this. I mean, we're sitting out here in this beautiful courtyard and a string quartet playing, and we're here. I'm driving. Have a little more." And she goes, "No, I don't like the way it makes me feel. And I should have left well enough alone. I should have just said, okay. But it really piqued my interest. Because it was a very, very strange thing to say. So I said, how does it make you feel? And she said, as you said, Carl, I'm here at a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I'm looking at the beautiful colors of the countryside. I'm listening to an incredible string quartet. And I'm here with three of the other people that I love the most. And I'm having a wonderful conversation with you. And if I drink a little bit too much, the colors start to get blurry and dull. The music starts to sound shallow and off in the distance. And I can't connect in conversation with you. Do you hear this? She's just described the exact opposite relationship to alcohol than I have. Because what she's saying is, of and by herself, she can see the colors of life. She can hear the music, and she can connect with people she loves. She adds a little alcohol, and it all gets dull and blurry and sloppy. Me, of and by myself, I cannot see the colors of life. I can't hear the music, and you're really goddamn boring. I add alcohol, and somewhere between the third to fifth drink, the colors come alive. The music. Oh, I'll tell you where that cello was made, whether I know or not. And you become very interesting. But not as interesting as me. That's it. That is why I will go to the gates of insanity or death behind this, because, you see, I don't drink to escape feelings. I drink to feel in the first place. And nobody but an alcoholic can understand this. This is why they stand off on the sidelines and go, what? How could you do this again? And from the depths of my soul, I'm going, if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't ask me. You wouldn't ask me why I do it. And that's been my problem. My biggest problem also has always been how to get you happy with me and me happy at the same time. I was never able to put those two things together. You see, when I'm happy, which meant I was somewhere between the third and fifth drink, you were freaking out. Oh, no, not again. No, no, no. All right, we're out of here. We're going to jail if we stay around you. Or you're angry, angry. But when you're like hopeful and, oh, good, Carl. We love you. I'm dying inside because you've taken alcohol away from me. I was never able to put those two things together where I am at peace and you're happy with me. I was never able to put those two things together until a significant time in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, this is what I believe that the whole point of Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's to solve my spiritual malady. And my spiritual malady is I cannot see the colors of life, I can't hear the music of life, and I can't connect with you in any meaningful way, shape, or form. And Alcoholics Anonymous is all about awakening this dead spirit. That what I've just described is the symptom of a dead spirit, that thing that makes us us, who you really are. Mine was dead. I needed to have a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience significant enough to awaken and bring alive that which is me, that thing that is me, to be able to see the colors of life, hear the music of life, and connect with you in a deep and meaningful way. So I propose to you that Alcoholics Anonymous does nothing about, if we put the disease of alcoholism into three columns, if I had a PowerPoint, I would do this, or a blackboard, in column number one is the allergy. Allergy of the body, the physical symptom of alcoholism. In column two, I have mental obsession. Strange mental blank spot. Mental obsession, best way I can describe it is at 9 a.m. it was a bad idea to take a drink. Nothing significant happens, and at 3 p.m. it's a good idea. The book describes that as a strange mental blank spot. I am completely susceptible to that. And in column three, I have the spiritual malady. And it's my proposition to you that Alcoholics Anonymous does nothing about column one. It will do nothing about the fact that I crave when I drink. I propose to you that Alcoholics Anonymous does nothing about column two directly. It's my proposition to you that Alcoholics Anonymous is completely about column three. Solve the spiritual malady. Awaken my spirit. I am no longer susceptible to the mental obsession, the strange mental blank spot, which renders column one a moot point. Because if I don't take the first drink, who cares that I'm allergic? Who cares that I crave? Right? And so my whole goal in Alcoholics Anonymous is to work on column three. And how did that happen in my life? How did that happen? First thing is I had to surrender to the fact of what I just described. I can't drink successfully. I cannot on my own not drink successfully. And I'm spiritually sick. I have to accept that at the depths of my soul. When they say we had to admit to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic, it means that it has to reach my subconscious. Here's a symptom, not always true, but I like to say this. How many people have had drinking and using dreams? Where you wake up in the dream, you're drinking, and you wake up, oh! Right? And you're ever so grateful, usually, if you're on the right path, that, whoa, it's just a dream. What do dreams deal with? It's our subconscious. I like to challenge you that it actually, this is a symptom if you're getting a drinking and using dream. It might have just reached your subconscious, because that's what dreams deal with, is the subconscious. What am I wrestling with? And it may be a profoundly positive sign that you are dreaming about this. Because did you ever dream about it when you were loaded? No. No. It's when you were sober or trying to get sober that you get these. It may have reached your subconscious. Not always true in every case, but it can be a very positive thing, not a negative experience. I need to completely surrender to that. Okay, if I have no power when I'm drinking because of the physical allergy, and I have no power when on my own I'm not drinking because of the mental obsession, and I seem to be unable to solve my spiritual malady, what must be my solution? If I'm powerless, what must be my solution? If I'm homeless, what must be my solution? A home. But you can't just walk up to the homeless guy. You guys got homeless people in Iceland? Not really, huh? You can't just walk up and say, hey, get a house. However, if you have previously been homeless and you now have found out how to get a house, you could walk up to that person and say, tired of living on the street? I got a solution. And what I did was if in the U.S. this is what you need to do. I went down and bring the person, and we stand in a line for 4.5 hours to talk to the first clerk-type person at a state or county office. You then go over and stand in another line for about another 4 hours. Then you have to wait. Then they put you into some sort of temporary housing, if you qualify. And then you have to keep doing a whole bunch of work and forms and do this work and do this work. And you can actually walk a willing homeless person through the system to where they get into what we call Section 8 housing, where they actually have a house. You can walk them through the process by which to get there. You can't just say, hey, homeless guy, get a house. You just go, well. Right? But you can walk a willing person through. And this is exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous did with me. Is they said, hey, powerless guy, I found a power sufficient to solve alcoholism. Walk with me. The first thing that the book is asking me to do here, it's the essence of step two. It's in We Agnostics. And it's so simple, we so often miss it. But it's the essence of step two. So on page 47 in the English version, middle paragraph, we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? Notice it does not say, what are your spiritual ideas? Can you define God sufficiently for us that we would believe that you know what you're talking about when you are mentioning God? What were you raised with? And where do you want to go? What spiritual dogmas have you read, or what do you have in your mind? It doesn't say anything of the sort. It says we needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe? Which means the answer to the question is, I'm not really sure, but I guess so. It can be that simple. And the very next sentence is a very powerful statement. As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him he's on his way. Notice that they don't say we hesitantly, we're not really sure based upon our experience, we're still thinking about it. It says we emphatically, with much enthusiasm and conviction, we assure you, you are on your way, move forward. The only time that we want to stop here is if somebody says, completely unwilling, there is no power greater than myself, and I'm only willing to believe that person if they can actually define their atheism to my satisfaction. Otherwise, I go, you're not even an atheist. Because to be a true atheist, you need to be able to enter a conversation where you can prove there is no God in your life. And most people that claim that, they don't even know who Friedrich Nietzsche is, to be able to even use that as one of the great historical correlations to there is no God. They just go, oh, well, I don't believe this stuff. Well, then what you are is a chicken shit agnostic is what you are, right? So 99% of the people that I work with say, yeah, I'm even willing to believe, right? I'm certainly willing to believe. Move forward. Let's not hesitate. And here's the reason that I don't like to hesitate when taking somebody through the steps the first time. Because my only job as their sponsor is to get them through the steps and acknowledge enough of the steps and to be able to take enough, have an experience with each step sufficiently to do the following. To be able to take somebody else through the steps. My job as a sponsor is to teach you to be a sponsor. That's when Alcoholics Anonymous happens between me and you. Prior to that, the only one that's getting any benefit out of this is me. My job as a sponsor is to teach you to be a sponsor, because that's where you're going to find the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's a symptom of when I know that Alcoholics Anonymous is transferred between me and another guy, is when the phone calls with a new guy that I'm working with, when the phone calls change from this type of phone call to this type of phone call. First type of phone call, you guys all heard it. Hey, sponsor, I've got this problem, and this problem, and problem number three has subset A, B, and C, and I need answers. Please help. When the phone calls change from that to this is when I feel Alcoholics Anonymous has actually happened between me and another guy. Hey, sponsor, I met this new guy at the meeting last week. I've been talking to him every day. He has this problem, and this problem, and I wanted to check with you about what I'm about to give him as advice so that I could just feel more comfortable in giving him the advice. Boom. He is now more concerned about somebody else than he is his own self. That's when the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous happens. Not before, in my experience. So, want to move forward, be able to get people through the steps. So, right at the end of what I was talking about in the last session were the A, B's, and C's, and C, that God couldn't, would have sought, right? And that's when you wake up at the beginning of the meeting and go, oh, meeting starting. The very next sentence says, being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and life over to the care of God as we understood him, just What do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Man, for a long time in my early sobriety, even after technically working step three, if I could have been honest, I would have sat in the meeting and I would have stood up whenever people would read the chapter five and they would go, three, made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. I would have wanted to stand up. What do you mean, and just what do I do? Because to me, that initially seemed like sort of like the sprinkling of some water on you. You know, I found God. I didn't understand it's extremely practical. And what I'm going to do may be considered blasphemous, but I'm going to reword step three, because it's my belief that my will and my... because I need to have something tangible. Will and life are intangible words. I don't know how to grab a hold of them. Try this. Go to the local recovery house. Go up there late at night, just before some guy with about 4 months goes to bed and say, hey, your life depends on your answer to this question. Were you living in the essence of step three today? Come on! He's going to go, I don't know. Or he's going to say something he heard in a meeting. But he's not going to be able to look you back in the eye and say, yes. Or look you in the eye and say, absolutely not. And it's important. It's important that he be able to look you back in the eye and say one or the other. Because those words are intangible. How do I know if I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God? Let's look at what my will is. Let's look at what my life is. I think I will take a drink of water. I think I will take a drink of water. If you're listening on a CD, I'm just sitting here. I'm not reaching for any water. I think I will take a drink of water. I've just changed my life. You might think negligibly, but let's extrapolate this out. Do you guys know what extrapolate? Let's bring this out into the bigger picture. Let's say, boom, right now, no water in Iceland. Done. Massive drought. You can't get any water. There's no way to get any more water from this second forward. I'm going to live approximately 9 hours more than you. That would be huge. That would have been that action that I took would have been life-changing, because in that 9 hours, maybe a glacier would melt and more water would come down. Right? So it could have been a massive change in the outcome of my life. Seemingly negligible. So my will is just my thinking. I think I will. I think I will. I will. Yeah. Plan to. I think so. That's just what my will is. My life is the sum total of the actions that I've taken so far. That's what my life is. My life is simply the sum total of the actions that I've taken. I can't seem to be... so let's change the wording of step three. Made a decision to turn my thinking and my actions over to the care of God as I understand them. You ever been able to easily control your thinking? I know that there are some spiritual ideas now where you can do that. But if you're brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I guarantee you, you are not able to control your thinking. You're sitting there trying to behave in front of your sponsor and some good-looking girl walks by and you're like, and you do not want, and if you had your thoughts broadcast out onto the internet, you would be quite embarrassed. Right? And you aren't able to control that. It just happens. And if you're, you know, if your sponsor knows you well enough, he'd say, hey, we're having a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous here. Right? And you snap your back and, oh, okay. Right? So let's throw out, for now, thinking. And reword step three again. Made a decision to turn my actions over to the care of God as I understood them. Made a decision to turn my actions over to the care of God as I understand them. Now, if I'm a newly sober alcoholic and I'm looking for a place to turn my actions over to that represents the care of God, because it's, again, intangible. oh, turn my actions over to the care of God. I need something concrete that at the end of the night, if I'm in a recovery house and some guy from AA comes and says, were you living in the essence of step three? I'm going to be able to turn back and say yes or no and look you in the eye and mean it. So I need to find a place as a newly sober alcoholic. I need to find a place to turn my actions over to that represents the care of God. Right? Here's like what I mean. Well, let me tell you why I think this first. It's my belief, and you may think this is kind of bizarre, it's my belief that Alcoholics Anonymous is 75 and a half years old. Yeah, 75 and maybe more. Okay? That approximately 76 years ago, all up there in the great meeting in the sky, that's what I like to call it, the big meeting in the sky. I've often wondered when, like, Chuck Chamberlain, Norm Alpie, or when Clancy dies, and they go to the big meeting in the sky, do they speak that night, or do they have to make coffee for a year? I'm not really sure. But up there in wherever it is that we go, about 76 years ago, in late 33, early 34, it's my belief that all of the great spiritual leaders that have ever been on the planet had a meeting, right? Abraham was there, Muhammad was there, Christ was there, Buddha was there, the Enlightened One was there, I mean, Gandhi, they're all just there. They're all there and they got together and you go, do you guys believe this? Look at this. Look at down on that planet. We have given mankind 100 different methods by which to find God. And look at these alcoholics. They're dying in the gutter, dying in the prison. Everybody is weeping. And we have given them hundreds of ways to find God. We need to take a vote. Do we really need to give them their own unique pathway to God? And they debated and they debated. And while they were debating, I think that Gandhi threw in, well, if we do, I believe that part of this solution that we're going to give them will have to be that they incessantly talk about themselves. So they took a vote and they said, yep, okay, we'll do it. And so they found this stock speculator and this proctologist. My late sponsor, Eddie Cochran, calls that odds and ends. Right? And they gave us our own specific pathway to God, pathway to solve the spiritual malady of the alcoholic. If you look at the history of AA and look at it closely, you cannot deny anything but the powerful hand of God. Because if you look at the history of mankind, and it just so happened that during this little blip on the screen, Silkworth was defining the problem. At the very same time, Carl Jung was extremely interested and found our solution. And just for a very short time, the Oxford movement became popular, right? And it was, whoop, gone. Yes, there's remnants of it around, but it's nothing compared to what it was at that time. And so Silkworth was, as we all know, Alcoholics Anonymous is our problem, our solution, and the plan of action to bring about that solution. Silkworth was defining our problem. Jung knew our solution. Oxford movement had a plan of action. But they didn't have each other. Right? Silkworth knew our problem, but didn't know what the solution was. He was quite baffled when Bill having he goes, I don't know what it is, but better hang on to it. Right? He had our problem, but no solution. Jung had the solution, but he didn't really know what the problem was, nor did he have a plan of action. And the Oxford movement had a plan of action, but they didn't know the problem and they didn't really know the solution. But they had a plan of action they were using. And all of these three things converged in on Bill and Bob. There's no way other than to describe that if you look at the history of mankind, it's kind of like in Arner's apartment. He's got this giant picture of the cosmos and a little dot that's human Earth, the planet Earth. And if you look at that same kind of thing as the immense history of mankind, and it just so happened that in this little blip of the history, those three things happened at once. There's no other way than to describe it than the loving hand of God. It can't be a coincidence. It cannot be a coincidence. So if I'm a newly sober alcoholic and I'm looking for a place to turn my actions over to that represent the care of God, where am I going to turn my actions over to? Alcoholics Anonymous. It's kind of like I told you that I got divorced about 3 years ago. We, after some fighting, and then we went to divorce counseling, which was even more important than our marriage counseling that failed. And I would strongly encourage anybody who goes through a divorce to go to divorce counseling. It's where you have a mediator that actually interprets through the anger what you're actually trying to say. It was invaluable in us reaching this agreement. My agreement was, she will be the primary caretaker of the children. I get to see them whenever and whatever. No arguments as to when they're with me or when they're with her, but she's the primary caretaker. In exchange for no arguments over this, when we got married, we bought this beautiful house right behind the 10th green at my country club where I golf. It's like a dream house, right? The agreement is that she gets to live there for 20 years, raise the children, and I pay all the bills. Right? I've been blessed financially in my life. I was able to do that. So that's the agreement we've made. That house behind the 10th green at my country club, the heat in the house, the food in the house, the clothes in the house represent my care of my children. It's a physical manifestation of my love for my children. It represents the care of my children. Now, every once in a while, not so much lately because I've had to work a lot, I travel a lot, but I might go up at daybreak to go with some guys that go off and tee off right at daybreak. Great group of guys, and I'll go up to the clubhouse. But in order to get to the country club, I have to drive right by the house. And let's say at 6 a.m. on a winter morning. Now, I know a winter morning in California is nothing compared to your winter mornings, but it's chilly at 6 a.m. And let's say I'm driving by, and I see my children out there naked in the driveway. I would slam on the brakes. I'd run up to them and go, Madison, Ryan, what are you doing? They're, Daddy, 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 we're freezing. We're freezing. We're freezing. And I'd look inside the window of the house, and I'd see my ex-wife in there making some breakfast, clothes on the bed, heat's on, fire's going. And I would say, get back in the house. Get back in the house. Oh, but Daddy, Daddy, my daughter, I've been struggling with some the math at school. I'm doing really well in reading. And my son would go, and there's this girl at school. She's making fun of me. She's making fun of me, and I don't know what to do. And I'd say, we're not even going to discuss that. Get back in the house. Once you're back in the house, we will discuss these other little problems that you have. I firmly believe that that's what God is saying to us all the time when we are on the outskirts of AA or neglecting sitting, taking our seat in our home group, not working with others, not doing our job in our home group. And then we pray to God, oh God, my relationship life is falling apart. My job life, my job, I'm struggling at work. God is saying, get back in the house and then we will discuss these things. If I'm not in the house, anything else that I am claiming to do spiritually is null and void as far as I'm concerned. Because the core being of who I am is an alcoholic. The core being of my solution is the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's then and only then that I get to have a relationship with my Creator. Because what's God going to say? What, you want me to give you like another gift that you're going to ignore also? Right? And so if I'm not in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, everything else is just moot. So the very next thing, is that the sound of what? Yeah. All right. So if I'm going to turn my will and life over to the care of Alcoholics Anonymous, and now, if I'm in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, it means I'm going to meetings. I've got a sponsor. I'm working steps. I'm learning to work with others. I have a commitment at my home group, which means if I'm not there, they notice, right? So, which I have, because of the traveling, they notice sometimes. But that's kind of the definition of a home group. When you're not there, they know you're not there because I'm regularly there. Those are the things that I have going in my life that keep me in the house. So now, I can walk up to the brand new guy that's in the recovery home with 4 months and say, if he's got this going on in his life, he goes to meetings, he's got a sponsor, he's taking steps, and he's learning to work with someone else. And did you know that if you've got 4 months, you can work with others? Even if you're only scratching the surface of maybe getting into step three. With 4 months, Carl? Oh, yes. You got a car? You are so valuable in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are uncomfortable taking the responsibility of carrying the message to somebody newer than yourself, then both of you get in the car and go to where the message is being carried, and you both get it. And you can be so overwhelmingly valuable to that brand new person that would not have gone had you not said, hey, get in the car, let's both go. There's quite a saying around Alcoholics Anonymous that step three is really shut up and get in the car. Right? So, but what's my next action? I need to take step four. I need to do a personal house cleaning. I need to back up a little bit onto step three to lead into step four. It's, again, this is just a theory. I may change my mind a number of years from now, but right now it's just a theory. And I've been, like, you've been attacked where somebody comes up, I listened to a tape of yours, and you said this and this and this, and I strongly disagree. And I go, what year was that? 1998. And I go, yeah, I disagree with it too now. I'm sorry, that's on a tape. They go, oh, all right. I need to look at this writing very, I'm going to do it briefly, but I should look at it very closely as to what Bill and the first 100 were writing about when they say, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Notice the word any life. I do not believe they are talking about alcoholics here. They are talking about the human condition. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Again, describing the human condition, most people live by self-propulsion. And they go on and talk about the director and the actor and da 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 da, and then they go, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. It's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Still talking about all of mankind. All you got to do is turn on the news, and you will see people stepping on the toes of others and retaliating, making decisions based on self, selfishness and self-centeredness. If we look at the history of mankind, that is absolutely it. They bring it home to the alcoholic here. So our troubles we think are basically of our own making, and they arise out of ourselves. Still talking about the human condition. And the alcoholic is the extreme example of self will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. So the whole world has a spiritual malady. The whole world. That's why people have put together religions and spiritual quests and spiritual paths, because people at some point realize, I don't want to live a half-measure life that is not full of meaning and purpose, and I'm going to go on a quest to search out my Creator. But many people don't do that. And what's their penalty? A half-measure life. Just not quite as full as it could have been. They don't have any self-realization. They're not really that much of service. They have all of the bedevilments that are described in here. But it's just sort of a half-measure wasted life. It's not really that. It's not a severe penalty. What's my penalty? See, I call my alcoholism my blessed curse. Because my penalty for not going on the path to seek my Creator is swift and it is sure. And I die an alcoholic death. And dying an alcoholic death does not mean, you know, I explode on the bar stool when I take a drink, right? Many people in AA think, yeah, that's what we're talking about. Oh, you're going to drink, you're going to die. Actually, the only thing we can guarantee you if you drink again is that you're going to have another one. That's the only thing we can guarantee you. I don't know what your pathway is, but I do know this. If you're an alcoholic of my type, I add alcohol, my spirit dies immediately. That which makes me quickly dies. I die a spiritual death, which leads then to the alcoholic death. That's the throwing up all over yourself where your mom is weeping and, you know, your children are astonished and are wondering how they're going to survive on this planet without you. and everybody is hurt, and your funeral is very, very solemn. There's no celebration. Family's embarrassed. When we move on one more page, it says, right before this, it says, you guys heard this? And we get into step four. Resentment is the number one offender. Have you ever felt, offender of what? What do you mean, number one offender? Well, in the English language, I'm no literary expert, but I do know this, that if the first sentence of a paragraph confuses you and you don't quite know what they're making reference to, back up by one paragraph and maybe even one sentence. So let's back up by one sentence where it says, resentment is the number one offender. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Another word for manifestation is symptoms. Resentment is the number one offender. What they're saying is, resentment is the number one symptom of a selfish life. Resentment is the number one symptom of a selfish person. We have two other big symptoms of a selfish person, other than resentment: full of irrational fear and always getting into sexual jackpots, where you're hurting other people by your sexual conduct, unaware of the power of your sexual desires and sexual actions, and you absolutely get yourself into very confusing situations. I know none of you do that here in Iceland. All right. So therefore, if these are the three things that are a symptom of a selfish life, and let's just use an example. What is resentment? It's from the Latin base word sente, to feel. So resente is to refeel and refeel and refeel. And what am I refeeling? I can't believe you did that to me. I can't believe you're thinking that about me. I can't believe you're thinking about planning to do this to me. Me, me. A person full of resentment is simply nothing other than an extremely self-centered person that thinks the world revolves around them and everybody else is just an actor in your play. I do not understand the bigger concept of we are all brothers and sisters of the Creator, and our only job is to figure out how to dance with each other. So resentment is the first one, and I'm going to look at them. And I'm not going to go into the semantics because I want to move forward. But I do want to point out on page 65 of the English translation, let's do this. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. If I'm going to do exactly what the book says without any workbooks and extra sheets, what am I going to do right now? In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. I'm going to go get a piece of paper. Just that, close the book. Don't read another sentence. Go get a piece of paper. We can assume a pen or a pencil. Right? We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we're angry. Close the book. Don't read anymore. Just, let's see some diarrhea. Just list them. You know, mom, dad, employer, this girlfriend, that ex-wife, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Just don't even say why, just ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. When you're done, and it's very important in this spiritual exercise that you do not go on and write about mom because she's first on the list, and then you spend four, that's how you wind up with the, I'm stuck on step four. How long have you been on? 4 months. I'm on my second resentment. Well, you're not doing it how the book is asking you to do the spiritual exercise. You're supposed to just write them down, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. And then go back. We asked ourselves why we were angry. Now let's take a look. You're going to completely block yourself from everything else if you don't write them all down first. Then go to column 2. Get it all down. Then go to column 3. We work down. And then unfortunately we have column 4, which most of us are quite astonished that the book is making us do this. Okay, so then now we're going to go over an inventory after we do that. I want you to notice on page 65 Because we often get pages and pages and pages. Now, later on in your life, if you need to do inventory a particular situation and it takes that much, great. But this blocks you from being able to get through the steps sufficiently to be able to take somebody else through the steps if you are going to write a novel. I mean, I had this one guy that I sponsored a long time ago. He turned in, it was about that thick on computer paper. He didn't tell me that he was doing it on computer. I would have objected, but he even had a table of contents. Right? He was a very, very analytical, he was a businessman, rather successful businessman. But he had, on the table of contents were pages 1 through 4, resentments. Pages 5 through 7, fears. Pages 9 through 175, sexual inventory. Teased him a lot about that one. Look at what it says on page 65. We were usually as definite as this example. Which means... you see these bullet points? Who he's angry at? And these bullet points? Let's read one. Mr. Brown, his attention to my wife, told my wife and my mistress, Brown may get my job at the office. That's not pages and pages and pages. That's some very concise bullet points. Let's get to the point, put it down on bullet points, and let's move on. Our goal is a spiritual awakening, not therapy. Okay? Our goal is to be able to work with others concisely and somewhat efficiently. We need to just, right there, boom, 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 move forward, get down to the next one. When we look at what the book is asking us to do, we can actually do this in a good, solid afternoon into an early evening. And we can do a sufficient job in order to have the experience that the book is asking us to have. So when we get to column 4, it's real easy. When we go back, let's just take a look at this. You know, it's telling us now we're supposed to look for referring to our list again, putting out of the minds of the wrongs of others, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Let's just look at Mr. Brown, his attention to my wife, told my wife or my mistress, Brown may get my job at the office. Real easy now, right? What's his own mistake? Come on, you Icelanders know. He's got a mistress, for God's sake. Boom. Now, and each one of these, if you look at it, you can immediately see where his column 4 would be. I've got a mistress. Now, when we do step 5, quite often these days in Alcoholics Anonymous, our people are coming to our sponsors with step 5, and they've got all 4 columns going. That's not what they were originally asking us to do. If you've ever, they refer to this as like a business inventory. Anybody ever taken an inventory for a business on warehouse shelves? Right, you've got a bunch of paper and a clipboard, and you're doing a lot of scratch and notes and stuff, and you know, after however many hours or days that you're taking these notes of what's there and what's damaged and all of that, you don't turn in your chicken scratch to your boss. You put it in a concise report. That's what he's looking for. What's saleable, what's not saleable. I contend with you in chapter 5 that chapter 5 says what it means. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Now, I firmly believe that these days in Alcoholics Anonymous, because so many people are so good with the steps, that you can actually get a lot of help by bringing all 4 columns to your sponsor, and they help you with that. No argument for me at all. But that's not what the book was originally asking. And look at why. Again, the idea, the wife throws the book at the guy in the orange grove. Get sober or leave. And he starts to do what it says, and then it says, admitted God to ourselves and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And if he's done all these columns and he doesn't have a sponsor who knows about Alcoholics Anonymous, right? That's why they don't mention sponsor in the big book. No other reason. Simply because an individual trying to get sober in the orange groves of California would not have been able to finish the process if he had to find a sponsor. The book says, now find a sponsor. So they say, a trusted person in the community, a spiritual advisor, right? Now, let's say this guy goes and chooses a trusted person in the community, and he starts to say, I am trying to change my life, and I need you to listen to something. And he starts going, Mr. Brown, he's an asshole. He's paying attention to my wife. He's telling my wife and my mistress. Brown, he might get my job at the office. My employer is unreasonable, unjust, overbearing, threatening to fire me for drinking and padding my expense account. That guy is going to say, stop. I don't want to listen to this crap. You told me you were on a spiritual quest. All you're doing is gossiping about the community. I don't want to listen to that. I'm too busy of a man to listen to that crap. However, if he comes to him and says, I'm on a spiritual quest, I need to get some things off my chest or I won't be able to stop drinking, and says, I've had this mistress, I've been betraying my wife, I love my wife. As a result of this, as a result of my drinking and my padding my expense account, my boss is going to fire me, and rightfully so. And the same guy that might get my job is actually flirting with my wife, and my wife wants to put the house in her name, and she has every right to do so. She's scared to death. I've got a mistress, and I'm about ready to lose my job. I need to figure out a way to make amends and make this right. Any person in the community would say, I see what you're trying to do. I totally see that you are trying to straighten out your side of the street. See what I'm saying? Step five does not say we admitted to God, to ourselves, another human being, the wrongs everybody had done us, and please help me find. No, I'm supposed to swallow big chunks of truth about myself. Now, these days, we often help. And right, great, we help the new person to see it. But the real spiritual exercise is swallow big chunks of truth about yourself. Okay, so 6 and 7. Again, in the 12 and 12, there is beautiful stuff, wonderful stuff that absolutely is vital to take a look at. And 6 and 7, wonderful stuff to do work later. But according to the book, I'm supposed to take 1 hour. And why do I want to do this? So that I can get to a place in my life where I can efficiently take somebody else through the steps so they can be in a position to work with others. I'm going to have much more deeper spiritual insights later in my sobriety if I can learn to work with others about 6 and 7 in my life. I'm going to have all sorts of situations arise that if I'm in the center of the house and I am solid in my efforts in recovery, I'm going to be able to face those things that I'm going to face in 6 and 7 through my sobriety. But right now, let's do what the book says. Right? Find a place alone. Doesn't need to be in your house. You don't got to go back to your... Find a place where you can be alone and ask yourself, have I left anything out? I'm going to talk about a couple of things that I left out here in a second. But I literally take an hour. Have I left anything out? Did I lie to my sponsor? Probably. Go back and straighten it out right now. You know that thing that you left out. That thing that just went in your brain that says, not, he's not talking about that thing. Yes, that thing. Well, I'm gonna do it right now. I'll tell you a couple of things that I left out with my sponsor when I did my inventory, my first inventory. And I had to go right back to him and say, as I stand before you here today, I do not know whether I've killed a human being or not. When I was about 18, I came out of a blackout and I was in my own bed in my parents' house. And I came out the back door, as I always would, to avoid the chance of running into anybody from my family. And I'd been on a 3-day drunk. And I came back out the side of the house, and there was blood, hair, and skin all over the bumper of my car. I don't know whether it was animal hair or human hair. I did a little bit of searching to see, was there a hit and run, anything in the news. I took a little bit of time to look, but I didn't. I was too terrified. I just went and cleaned it all off. I don't know. It's one of those things that I remember standing there that day. Nobody's going to know about this. Right. Another one is my first sponsor, Bob W. on the ship, thought that I was married when I got sober. So did everybody else in the Navy. Little embezzlement scam I had going on. Let me tell you about this little one. In my last 7 months of my drinking, I ran across this old girlfriend from college named Lisa. Beautiful girl. Loved her. Loved her then. Love her now. She was living in a little beach house in San Diego. I'm in the Navy in San Diego. We run across each other in the bar. Party! Right? And she's, oh, Carl! And as we are on this drunk, we enter into a 2 or 3 day drunk together. I find out she's really struggling making the rent on this little beach house. I like that beach house to get off my ship. I want her to keep that beach house. She wants to keep the beach house. I also want a lot more money to drink the way I'm drinking, because Navy paycheck, not enough. I'm not dealing any drugs anymore, so a little difficult. There's a little thing that United States Navy pays you double if you are married. So we got a brilliant idea in the middle of this drunk. We went and got married. Complete fraud right there. Right? So, fast forward, blah, 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 handcuffed, blah, blah, thrown into treatment, operation on my face, boom, I'm in treatment. Navy starts calling her. Oh, your husband's in treatment. You need to come in for family counseling. She's like, ah! So she runs and gets it annulled while I'm in treatment, delivers the paperwork to me of the annulment. She paid an attorney, borrowed money from her family, got it annulled. Delivered this to me in treatment. My roommate in treatment was what's called a personnelman. That's like a clerk in the Navy. And he goes, what's that? And I go, annulment on my marriage. He goes, and I go, oh, you're a personnelman. Where do I turn this in? He goes, oh, don't turn it in. Now I'm taking advice from my bunkmate in treatment. Oh, don't turn that in. They'll never know. Keep taking the money. And I'm going, well, I'm going to need extra money now that I'm going to be sober. So for the next 9 months of my sobriety, I am now not only in fraud, but now I'm in embezzlement. And I couldn't tell anybody, even my sponsor. My sponsor's in the Navy, too. I'm thinking he's going to go, oh, we need to go take care of this right now, and you're going to prison. Right? I can't tell you that I truly thought that, but that was my block. So now I had to run back to him, and I tell him exactly. And now we're going to... So those are the things that I left out. Okay? The other thing about step 4 and 5, 6 and 7 is I need to be able to tell myself the truth about my life. How far am I now? How long have I talked?
About an hour.
Okay. And I'll hopefully do this in about 10-15 minutes. I need to tell myself the truth about my life because the way I've been living my life, I don't even know what's true or not true. Here's an example. Let me tell you this little story. When I was maybe four and a half months sober, I started dating this girl named Chris. Or she actually hit on me. She 13-stepped me. It was horrible. I just couldn't believe that she did this. Right? So I'm dating this girl named Chris. She's about 4 years sober, and she's getting her master's in psychology. I think she was dating me just to, like, study the alcoholic inaction. Right? But anyway, whenever you start dating, you start talking about... Usually the conversation sooner or later comes down to when did you lose your virginity, right? So she told me that, and I told her when I lost my virginity. Told her when I lost my virginity. I was 12. My parents had hired this college-age babysitter to watch the house while they were gone for a couple of weeks, and I told her when I was 12, this 19-year-old took my virginity, and she goes, oh, I've studied about, you've been abused as a child. You've been molested as a child. You're going to have troubles your whole life. And I'm going, oh, shit. It didn't feel like I was molested. Oh, this is just horrible. Oh, no. I'm just trying to stay sober. Now you're telling me I was molested as a child? Oh, God. And so, right, now I'm really frustrated. The next day, I'm at a meeting, and I'm just like, oh, God. Oh, no. And in San Diego, they have podium participation. And at the meeting, for whatever reason, the guy, I'm sitting here, oh, God, I can't believe this. I just want to stay sober. Now they're saying I'm molested as a child. And the guy apparently saw me just, oh. And he said, you with the blonde hair, would you like to share? And I'm like, oh. So I walk up in front of the room, and I start telling them the story. I'm just trying to stay sober here. But now my girlfriend, who's getting a master's in psychology, says that I was molested as a child. And right in the middle of me saying that, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Bam! That was a lie. My buddy Dave lost his virginity when he was 15. I had to make up a story. We had both thought that Jeanette was very cute, the babysitter. So I had to tell him, oh, yeah. I lost mine back then with it, you know. I had continued to tell this story so often in my life that I had become to believe it to be true. You could have put me on a lie detector test before that moment, and I would have told that story, and the needle wouldn't have moved. And I remember that moment standing there in front of, there's probably 150 people at the meeting, and I was like, oh, I'm sorry, that was a lie. And I sat down. The real value of that experience was when I sat back in my chair. And I had this overwhelming experience of, what else in my life is not true? What else in my life is not true? I remember just having one of those, I was absolutely floored by my ability to manufacture lies. So that's what I need to get to, is the truth. Okay, so do the 7-step prayer, move forward. 8 and 9, I'm just going to tell you a couple of experiences, and a lot of it has to do with living amends and why we need to stay in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you one that worked out beautifully. Really good amend. Wound up wonderfully. Told you about, had a really, really bad night, therefore I joined the Navy, right? Too long of a story, but part of this story, drug deal went really, really badly. I owed somebody $30,000. I needed to get out of town. These guys that I owed $30,000 to, they knew my family. I'd known them most of my life. They had a couple other guys that they were associated with in order to try to recoup this money because they knew it wasn't coming from me. They put a couple of guys in suits and went to my parents' neighbor's house. This woman had a very, very lucrative jewelry business. They put on suits and they went up to the door, knock, knock, knock. One of them said, I'm getting married next week. Pastor Morris is the pastor. He referred me over to you to look at wedding rings. And she goes, oh, well, yeah, Pastor Morris referred you. Absolutely. Took him into the basement. They tied her up. They beat her over the head. They cleaned her out. This action that was taken upon that woman was a direct result of the way I was living. Although I wasn't there, this was exactly from the result of the way I was living. I needed to go back to her. This is one of the ones that works out beautifully. I'm 11 and a half months sober. I'm in Seattle on leave. There's a whole nother story on that, but we're not going to get into that. I knock on the door. I've got about $1,500 in my pocket that my sponsor had told me to come up. And one of the ones was I was going to make a down payment to her. And there was a few other down payments I was going to make and then make arrangements. There was like three things that I was going to try to straighten out on this trip. One of them was this. Knock on the door. She answers the door and I go, I'm Carl Moore. She goes, I know exactly who you are. And my name had come up in the investigation on all this and all of this, but now I'm already out of town. And I go, that robbery that happened a couple of years ago, that was as a direct result of the way I was living at the time. And she goes, I had suspected. And I go, what do I need to do to make this right? What do I need to do? And she goes, it's a funny thing, Carl. My husband had overinsured that jewelry by an immense amount. I got a huge insurance settlement worth three times what the jewelry was worth. And I used that settlement to start another business that I have found deep meaning and purpose in my life. It completely changed my life. I look at that as, although a traumatic experience, it was the changing point in my life that got me to do exactly what I love to do. And I'm about ready to say, well, I'm glad I could be of service. But I didn't, and I said, what do you need me to do? And she goes, just do the following. You ever take another drink, Carl? You never. You never come into this neighborhood. Your parents have moved out of this neighborhood. I never want to see your face within 1,000 miles if you take another drink. And I go, okay, done. Okay? But I had to go to that door. I had to go to that door. Here's another one. And this is based upon living amends. And then I'm going to sit down because it's almost dinner time. This one time when I was also somewhere around 18 or 19. And I don't know if you guys know the Seattle area, but Seattle is split by Lake Washington between downtown Seattle and downtown Bellevue. Bellevue and Redmond are over here. That's where Microsoft campus is, and downtown Seattle. There's two bridges, I-90 and 520. The 520 bridge is an extremely busy on mornings of people coming from the Bellevue-Redmond area into Seattle for work or for whatever they're doing. I'm in the middle of a 2 or 3 day drunk. It's 5 in the morning. I'm coming across the 520 bridge. I completely wipe out. I have what I call throwaway cars. Drug dealers have throwaway cars. Cars that are not registered in anybody's name. And you can leave. Leave the car there if necessary. Right? And then they got to do fingerprints and all of this type of stuff. But So I'm in a throwaway car. And I completely wipe it out. Spin, spin, spin. Crash, crash, roll. And I'm like, oh! And I'm blocking all of the traffic coming in for the whole weekday morning into Seattle. Possibly 100,000 cars, because the car was left there, I later found out, for over 4 hours before they were able to get all of the mess cleaned up and able to get traffic going. Approximately 100,000 people. Now, I'm the kind of guy, years later, I'm down on a street corner, bottle in my hand, dirty leather pants, rusty earrings. I'm only hurting myself. Leave me alone. What do you want? What? But I have no concept of the larger picture of the world. And this is, the Hindus call it karma. I need to somehow make this right in the universe. And you see, and I'm not just blocking people on their way to work and they're just late for work. Out of that, all those possible 100,000 people that were delayed, how do I know there wasn't a man desperately trying to get to a job interview so he could feed his family, and he didn't make it that morning and wasn't able to feed his family? How do I know there wasn't a woman desperately, had just gotten a phone call that her father is dying in Swedish hospital just across the bridge, and she was desperately trying to get there to say her last words before he passed, and she didn't make it? How do I know things like that, very likely that stories like that are all part of that, and my actions blocked the universe in that way? How do I make up for that? How do I make up for that? That's why whenever Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to do stuff, I'm there. Chuck C. used to call it, all I'm trying to do is rub out the record. And it's just another way, his sort of southern way of saying, I'm trying to get right with the cosmos. I'm trying to get right with the universe. Because the damage is severe. The damage of the alcoholic is severe. And these are just a couple small ones. I got other things. And I need to do whatever I can in Alcoholics Anonymous. My greatest gift is sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need to look further. I don't need to look further. So, it's all I'm trying to do in Alcoholics Anonymous these days. And you know what? I think I'm getting close. But I got a long journey ahead. But I'm getting signs in my life that I'm getting close. My children, I believe, are a beautiful, beautiful gift from the universe. That I've been able to experience the depth of this love with my children is only a result of, I believe I'm starting to get okay, right with the universe. This is 24 years later. 24 years later. So I encourage you, take your seat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Have a great dinner, and we'll see you later tonight.